Okay, well, my name is Ken Murray. I'm from Duleek in County Meath. The nearest town to me would be Drogheda. So back in early 1979, I suppose the local station had come on in Drogheda. It was called LRD, Local Radio Drogheda. And it seems nobody had any experience of working on radio. Most of the people who were on LRD basically were local DJs who worked in local nightclubs. There was no tradition of people working in journalism. I had always wanted to be a television cameraman. That was my ambition. No interest in working in radio at all. But when RTÉ2 television opened in 1978, RTÉ took on, I think, about 15 trainee cameramen, and I was told they wouldn't be recruiting for a long time. So if I wanted to get into the media, radio was a possible way in. LRD, as it was called, was looking for people. They held a DJ competition. I don't think I ever spoken to a microphone in my life. I went in. There was a prize of £100. And it seems I got the job. And I started in the summer of 1979 on LRD, which was the local station then in Drogheda. But as time moved on, the station wanted to expand the signal, to take in places like Navan and Trim and a wider population area like Balbriggan and Newry, simply to pull in more advertising. It made sense. So they changed the name then to Boyneside Radio. Now, one of my unusual claims to fame, if indeed modesty allows me to record such a, I suppose, an attribute, is that back in October 1979, I started a programme on LRD called The Green Scene. Instead of playing non-stop pop music day in, day out, I was asked to do a slot on a Saturday morning between 10 and 12. It used to be called Hospital's Request. I said, look, I'm going to do something different. So I decided I'd play 2 hours of Irish music, Irish country and Irish ballads, and a bit of Irish traditional music thrown in. Now, that wasn't hip and trendy at the time, because all the pirate stations were playing non-stop pop music. And there was a great reaction to it. And to this day, the Green Scene went from LRD to Boyneside Radio to LMFM. And 39 years on, that programme is still on the air. And to the best of my knowledge, it is the longest running programme on commercial radio in this country.
So how old would you have been then when you started in pirate radio? And had you been... You mentioned that it wasn't kind of your first area of interest. Had you known of pirate radio before? Had you any interest in it? Were you a fan?
No, the history was that... the history was, as I recall, that there was a number of stations on in Dublin. I think there was Radio Melinda, there was Radio Ballyhaclia, and there was Radio Dublin. And then, as I recall, either late 1977 or early 1978, the Sunday World newspaper did a big splash on the popularity of Radio Dublin. And the vast majority of people were not aware, certainly outside Dublin, that there was pirate radio stations in the city, but that they operated within a loophole within the law. And that's what allowed them to get on air. This loophole. There was nothing in the old 1926 Wireless Telegraphy Act that said it's an offence to own a transmitter. It's an offence to broadcast. And that's how they operated. They operated within this grey area within the law. So after the Sunday World did this huge expose on Radio Dublin, pirate stations just began mushrooming all over the place. There was a pirate station nearly in every town in the land. But it gave people a local voice. People could hear local DJs, local requests, local journalism. And basically it was an extra addition to the local media landscape. So that was the situation back in 1979. The only station I would have been aware of, as I said, was LRD, which came on the air, I think it was late 1978. And 6 months later, I joined them.
And in terms of them talking about LRD, how many people were involved with that station? Was it a very small local running, or was it sort of a big business behind it?
There was a businessman called Ebon MacDonald. He was a house builder, and he had been approached by two local DJs who saw what was happening elsewhere, and they basically said, look, these radio stations are popping up all over the place. Each town has its own station. And could you set it up? We know how to set it up. We know what equipment is required. And it's a case of getting hold of somebody who can either buy a transmitter or make a transmitter. And probably the biggest expense you'll need is a mast to get the signal out. And Ebon had a lot of property where he had space. So we ended up operating from an attic in a disused mill. So we had our own studio, we were up and running, and from day one proved to be a very popular station. And one thing about LRD, which later became Boyneside, was that unlike the stations in Dublin, we were not playing non-stop pop music every day and every hour. We actually did a lot of talk. We did local issues. We did local sport. We even broadcast Mass on a Sunday. We'd simply go down with a tape recorder, broadcast Mass from a recording from the previous night. And we were doing, I suppose, what could be described as a cross between a pop station and a talk station. There were local issues being discussed, and we were holding local councillors to account. So it was a format of radio. It's the norm now for local stations outside Dublin. But at the time, this was quite a novelty. This was a whole new departure from listening to a station in Dublin that played non-stop hits, but we were doing current affairs, we were doing sport. And in the Drogheda area, everyone took to us, you know, in a very positive way.
Mm. So what was that interaction then with your listeners like? Were, you know, was there a direct phone line to them? Did they often get in contact with you?
It was a combination of people ringing in and people either posting in. It probably sounds like old technology these days, but people would post in postcards and letters. And what a lot of people did was they would physically walk to the office in the centre of town, and they'd come in and they'd say to the receptionist, "I want to play a request for my Auntie Mary, who's 65 years of age next week." And we'd write it down, and somebody would bring it up to the DJ, and it would get a mention. And it was as simple as that. I mean, it was the old way of doing things, but it worked. Mm. But the fact that you were mentioning local people's names and voices on air proved very, very popular. And then we'd be out and about doing discos. So you'd be engaging with people, and they'd hand you requests. And there was a lot of involvement. And as time moved on, the local councillors, the local clergy, the local sports bodies began to see the value of radio, that it was a, I suppose, an electronic version of the local newspaper.
And so what was the frequency then of Boyneside, formerly LRD?
Yeah, Boyneside was on 225 metres medium wave. And subsequently it went on FM. Now, the FM wasn't exactly stereo. It was more like a mono FM, but at least we were there. It should be pointed out that up until, I think, the early 1980s, what happened was that everybody listened to medium wave on the radio. It was only as time moved on that FM became more popular because the sound quality was better, and bit by bit, medium wave was phased out. So what you had was everybody listening to medium wave. I think the arrival of Radio Nova changed all that, because they suddenly had this crystal clear FM sound with proper what's called left and right stereo separation. And that upped the game big time. Everybody had to move their operation up a gear to match Radio Nova, but we were on 225 metres medium wave. Now, I'm not well up on the technology, but I'm told that one of the difficulties in those days was trying to find a spare or an empty space on the band that you could use that wasn't interfering with someone else's frequency. Apparently there's only so many frequencies in medium wave assigned to various countries, but we were on 225 metres.
And obviously one of the most famous things about the pirate radio era was the raids. Were you ever raided? Was your signal ever jammed when you were in Boyneside Radio?
I think Boyneside was raided once. And I wasn't there, but of what I've heard, it was raided once, and a solicitor was employed, and the solicitor had to go to the Gardaí and basically say, "You do realise the pirate stations, they're not breaking the law, because nobody could point to a piece in the 1926 legislation that amounted to a clause being breached. But you had RTE kicking up a lot of noise, saying that the pirate stations were interfering with Garda frequencies, ambulance frequencies, and there was resistance. There was a bit of hostility from RTE towards the pirates because the pirates were biting into RTE's listenership. I don't recall a raid, but I know in Drogheda, if Drogheda is the, I suppose, the reflection of what was happening around the country, in Drogheda what was happening was, you know, the Gardaí were listening into the various programmes. The Gardaí were having requests played for their girlfriends and their wives and their sons and daughters. And they took the attitude that as long as you didn't libel somebody, as long as you didn't call for somebody to be shot dead, as long as you behaved yourself within the broadcasting laws of the day, you know, best to turn a blind eye and a deaf ear.
And were you working there on sort of a voluntary basis, or were you getting paid for the work that you did?
Well, I was still at school. I was doing my leaving cert. So I would come down after school, do my programme in the evening, go home, work again at the weekends. And there was the great expectation at the time that, you know, if you worked on a pirate station and if you put the hours in, that sooner or later the government of the day would make the whole thing legal and then suddenly you'd have a job for life. The only problem was that it was another 10 years before the government of the day decided to set up a legal, I suppose, framework, the whole licensing of radio stations, to, I suppose, do away with the pirate era and make the whole thing legit. Because one of the other complaints about pirate stations was they were playing... they were playing music, but they weren't paying the royalties for the plays. Now, the other side of it was, of course, that a lot of Irish artists weren't complaining because they were getting exposure for their songs that they weren't getting on RTE.
And just kind of going on there from introducing that legal framework, obviously at the end of December, 31st December 1988, the pirate stations obviously were forced to shut down. Were you still on the air? Were you involved with any station?
No, I was with Boyneside until April 82. And then Gavin Duffy, Richard Kenny, who went on to RTE under his real name, Richard Crowley, and myself, we went to work for Radio Leinster, which is a pirate in Dublin. And of course, working in Dublin, you had, you know, a bigger audience. I suppose if you were from a country station, you could be heard by the powers that be in RTE. The thinking being that if you were heard on a Dublin station and you applied to RTE, the likelihood was that somebody might say, "Yes, I heard you on the radio. I know what your standard is, and here's a job, and the best of luck to you." That was the thinking. But I was with Radio Leinster until about 1982, and then for me a chance came up to work for BBC Radio Ulster out of Dublin. So I worked for Radio Ulster out of Dublin for 2 years, and then I went I drifted into newspapers as a reporter, because the pirate radio thing was dragging on, for the want of a better description. People were not making a good living. Some people weren't getting paid at all. The owners were basically pocketing the money from the commercial advertising they were pulling in. And I took the view that if I didn't find an alternative career, you could end up on pirate radio all your life, but not be able to afford to buy a house. So by November 82, I was out of pirate radio. But, you know, I was watching what was going on.
And do you have any sort of interesting or memorable anecdotes from your time in pirate radio that that really stand out to you, or you know, that would be you'd welcome on an archive, say?
Well, I know in Drogheda, if indeed Drogheda, you know, is a reflection of the way the local pirate station was engaging with the local council. Initially, what I recall was that Gavin Duffy, for example, had a talk show called The Lunchtime Special. It was on between 12 and 2. And Gavin took the view, rightly, that if he could get the political councillors on board to take part in the programmes, that if the Gardaí, for example, heard the councillors and the politicians on the air, they would take the view that, you know, pirate radio is a good thing, serves the community, and it's in everyone's interest that the thing is licensed in a legal operation. I suppose one of my memories is that Gavin initially had to meet councillors one by one by one and persuade them that if he was talking about an issue in Drogheda, just say, for example, it was, just say he was talking about, you know, potholes or bad street lighting or rubbish collection. If he could just get one on and the other 11 councillors heard that one person on, they might say, well, Johnny O'Brien was on Gavin's show tomorrow. Maybe I should go on as well if I'm invited. The thinking being of the politicians at the time was they were afraid to go on pirate radio because they thought their opponents might take the view, well, if you're going on pirate radio, you're supporting an illegal enterprise. It would look bad for the councillors. So I think Gavin, on one occasion, persuaded a councillor from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Labour to go on his programme. And when the other councillors heard those three councillors on, you couldn't keep them off the air. Now, it might sound amusing now, and there's no problem getting politicians now to go on air, but at the time, it was a very sensitive issue, simply because if you were seen to be on a pirate station, you were seen to be, if you like, breaking the law. And do bear in mind that at the time, the vast majority of people on a pirate station used different names. They did not use their own name for one simple reason. If you were arrested by the Gardaí on the basis that you took part on a pirate radio station and you were hauled into court, well, if you were arrested under your own name, you could be prosecuted. But if you were using a name, you know, just say you called yourself on air Elvis Presley, if you were hauled into court and a guard there stood up in the court and says, I arrested Elvis Presley at 4:04 on Tuesday, your solicitor could say, well, actually, that is not the name of my client, so the case would be struck out. So DJs were using alternative names to try and get around any difficulties with the law. And it should be pointed out as well that at the same time, RTE kept pushing out this line, if you work on a pirate station, don't expect to get a job in RTE. And this was causing a problem as well. This was RTE engaging in scaremongering. RTE's thinking was that if nobody works in pirate radio, they'll all close down and RTE will have the nation all to itself. But it should be pointed out, and it should never be forgotten, that the success of the pirate stations at the time forced RTE to lobby the government to set up, in 1979, RTE Radio 2. RTE Radio 2 was set up purely to stop the growth of the popularity of the pirate stations. So that's one of my memories from that particular era. I mean, everything was done on a shoestring. You know, most DJs bought their own records. Most DJs put in a lot of hours, a lot of time, and a lot of commitment simply to build up their profile, develop their personal skills on air, improve their professionalism in the hope of getting a job, we'll say, in the likes of RTE, where you got a decent sum of money, you had basically a job for life, and if you wanted to go to the bank manager and look for a mortgage, and the bank manager said, well, what do you do? Well, I work in RTE. Oh, fine, I can give you a mortgage. But if you said you worked on a pirate station, you would not be treated with the same level of respect.
So then I guess my final question is kind of a little bit off that, and you're talking about working on, you know, the shoestring budget. What was the sort of technology and equipment setup that you would have had working in the pirate radio stations that you did?
Yeah, sure. In our case, a guy called Eddie Caffrey just not only was a DJ, he just happened to be a bit of a whiz kid when it came to local engineering, in that he could build his own transmitters in his back garden. And, you know, Boyneside Radio, LRD, was blessed to have him, because not only was he doing his programme, he kept expanding the signal. Now, in the early days, one thing I do recall was that in the early days, around 1979, if you wanted to listen to the local station in Drogheda, you tuned into 225 metres and there we were, and that was fine in the day. But when the night time came, the signal, it's got something to do with the atmosphere, the way the signal transmits, you couldn't hear us because there was a whistle noise. It was a sort of a type noise. And I didn't realise it at the time, but I was subsequently told it was because we didn't have what's called a crystallised frequency. Some little gadget you put into the transmitter, and it was like a crystal, and it meant that the signal could be heard then at night time. But for 6-7 months, once it got dark, you couldn't hear the station. Once again, homemade technology. We use a thing called a H&H mixer. A H&H mixer was usually used by bands. If a band was setting up its sound system in a nightclub, they would use a mixer, a sound mixer. So we would use a H&H mixer, and we were using Lenco turntables. So you had a Lenco turntable on your left, Lenco turntable on your right. You had two cassette players on your right, two cassette players on your left. The cassettes played the ads, they played the jingles. So you were working off cassettes. You know, the likes of BBC Radio 1 and RTÉ were using what are called cart machines, which self-cued themselves. You played it and the tape wound on till it came to the start. So when the light flashed red, you could then hit green and it would play. But we would have to cue them ourselves. So it was very basic homemade technology. But the listener was none the wiser of the chaos that was going on in terms of lining up records, lining up ads, lining up jingles. And I always remember too that one of the things that was quite stressful in a pirate station was if you were doing your program, you had to take the requests yourself on air. So you'd introduce your song, you'd line up the record. We had a light on the phone, so when the phone rang, you didn't hear the phone ringing, the light flashed, so you knew the phone was ringing. So you picked up the phone while the song is playing and you say hello, and somebody at the other end would say, can I play a request for my Auntie Mary, who's 72 tomorrow? That comes in from her niece Mary and her nephew John. So you're writing down the request as the song is playing. And the trick was to try and get the request written down before the song finished, and at the same time have the next song lined up. Now, the Dublin stations, I think, did it slightly different. They were lucky in that most of them had somebody who answered the phone for them. But in our case, you answered the phone yourself, you engaged with the listener, and it was quite stressful, but it worked. And we enjoyed the buzz of the whole thing, and, great days, and it put a lot of people on the road. Should add, by the way, I mentioned earlier on that I started what is now the longest-running programme on commercial radio, The Green Scene. It's on LMFM, and it first started in 1979. When the licence was issued for the Louth-Meath area, I was one of the first recruits to LMFM, because by then I had got out of music presentation. I'd been a newspaper journalist. I did a lot of work with RTÉ and the BBC in Belfast. So I joined LMFM as a reporter in the newsroom. But LMFM was on air, I think, about 6-7 months when Liam Riley, who used to sing with the band, he still sings with the band Bagatelle, he qualified to represent Ireland in the Eurovision Song Contest in Zagreb. And I remember approaching Gavin Duffy, the then CEO of LMFM, and saying, look, Liam Riley from Dundalk is representing Ireland in the Eurovision Song Contest. I'd like to go. I can do updates for news, but I can put a documentary together. And what he said to me was, and I always remember this, and I thought it was quite visionary, he said, look, we can't afford to send you, but if you can get somebody to sponsor it, off you go. So I approached a few businesses. Coca-Cola had a plant in Drogheda at the time, and they came up with the money. So I went off to Zagreb. I did updates for news, and I did loads of interviews. And I compiled all the interviews for a one-hour documentary about Liam Riley's week at the Eurovision Song Contest in Zagreb in Croatia. And what I did was, I sent a copy of the documentary to the radio reviewer in the Irish Times. I sent a copy to the radio reviewer in what was then the Sunday Tribune. And they all wrote glowing tributes about the documentary and that this was a whole new departure for legal local radio, because the stations were only on the air a few months. And to my surprise, I won a Jacobs Award in 1990. And this is back in the time when they only issued 14 awards, 7 for radio and 7 for TV and film. And I got the very first national award for commercial radio in Ireland, a Jacobs Award in 1990. And now you have the PPIs and the IMROs, and they're giving out 20, 30 awards every year. But I got the very first one, and it set a template. And it made, if I say so myself, it made the people who dish out the awards take local radio quite serious. And as a result, as you know, RTÉ now recruits quite a lot from the local stations. So, you know, pirate radio has put a lot of people on the road, proved very popular. The only concern I had about the whole thing going legal was that while it was 10 years maybe too late for a lot of people who had hoped to get into it at an earlier age, and some people drifted out of it, some people emigrated and worked in radio in Britain. The one just disappointment I had was that when the whole thing went legal, the various licenses went to people who it seems were supporters of the Fianna Fáil government of the day. Mm. A lot of people who were really into radio, understood programming, lost out. So you could have a situation where somebody got a radio license, knew nothing about radio, but, you know, they made their money running a supermarket, or they made their money building houses, or they made their money selling cattle. So a lot of business people got these licenses to make money, but a lot of the people who really were into radio, really into the equipment, were really into programming, didn't get the chance to own their own stations. Mm. But overall, it's evolved quite well. Mm.